We're going to be organic purchaser.
Oh, and I agreed to take a picture.
I had non-organic grapes the other day.
Today is February 19th, 2018. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee and Human Services. Today we have two informational hearings, one on the Oregon Commission of Hispanic Affairs and one on the Department of Human Services Oregon Health Authority on the update on the eligibility transformation, integrated eligibility, and Medicaid eligibility projects.
Jeez, that was a lot.
Ms. Ames, why don't we open up an informational meeting on the Oregon Commission of Hispanic Affairs?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, our first item this morning is the Hispanic Commission. I'm going to discuss mental health disparities in the Latino community. And I did want to mention that Representative Alonzo Leon was kind enough to facilitate this presentation for us.
And so coming up right now is Alberto Moreno, Linda Castillo, and Diana St. Amour. So please begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, esteemed committee members. We're delighted to be here today before you to share some of our findings related to mental health parity report that my commission has commissioned. It's a first ever report of its kind, if you would believe it, in the history of Oregon. And so we're delighted to share those results with you. Again, for the record, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And we'll introduce some of our folks here today who can get started on the presentation.
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members. My name is Diana St. Amour, and I'm a Master of Social Work student at Western New Mexico University, and I am delighted to present my findings on the mental health disparities for Latinos in Oregon today. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, Co-Chairs, Vice Chairs, and committee members. I'm Linda Castillo. I'm the Vice Chair. I'm also the Vice Chair on the Oregon Commission of Hispanic Affairs. Good morning.
I'm Lucy Baker. I'm the administrator. I'm running slides.
All right. Please begin when you're ready.
Okay. Well, we're really delighted to be here this morning. As Chair Moreno mentioned, this is the first ever opportunity for this type of presentation, so we're very excited to share these details today. And we're also happy to say this is kind of a shared research policy project with OHA and DHS. And today is just kind of the starting point of presenting this kind of data and information. And we hope that we have more to come and share with you in the future. So I will say I am pinch hitting today for Kimberly Volker, who is our research intern. She was out ill today. So I'm going to be reading, unfortunately, a little bit more to you than I normally would. And Kimberly is at the Oregon Health Sciences University as an epidemiology student. And she is working in this project with Diana St. Amour, and it's been really wonderful for her to present this qualitative information. So I'll begin, and we'll start with slide one. And as you see here, it's the disparities for Latino Oregonians, the exploratory analysis using administrative data. So she had a bazillion points of data. There's an exact number for sure, but it was a lot of information that she went through to really gather this information. So as we know, and are learning more, the Latino population is the largest minority population in the state of Oregon, with some groups estimating the population size at just under 500,000 individuals, or 12% of Oregon's population. The Latino population in Oregon has been growing at a faster rate than that of the entire United States, with the Oregon Latino population almost doubling from 275,000 in 2000 to 400,000 in 2010. Oregon's growth is fueled primarily by a rise in the number of U.S.-born Latinos rather than immigration. In fact, nearly two-thirds of Oregon Latinos were born in the United States. The largest number of Latinos reside in Washington County, where the population has grown from 50,000 in 2000 to 99,000 in 2014. Although we are aware that the Latino population has increased risk for various physical conditions, such as greater rates of adult and childhood obesity and diabetes compared to white Oregonians, there is relatively little information regarding the Latino population's mental health needs, especially for Latino Oregonians. And the report has occasionally been contradictory, with some researchers reporting similar mental health between Hispanics and white population, some showing improved mental health for Latinos and still others showing worse mental health for Latinos. In 2015, the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey showed that the Latino youth were slightly more likely than their white peers to have reported suicide attempts, which is consistent with another study that shows Latina high school girls having higher rates of suicide attempts. Another study showed that the Latino Americans were more than likely to experience worse depression than white American females, with 53% of Latinas experiencing moderate to severe depressive symptoms compared with 37% of white American females. However, the national study on drug use and health showed that Latino adults were less likely than white Americans to have any mental illness or of serious mental illness. These contradictory results may be explained in part by the fact that Latinos are less likely to seek mental health treatment. In 2001, the Surgeon General's report found that only 1 in 5 Latinos with symptoms of psychological disorders spoke to their doctors about their mental health, and the National Alliance on Mental Health reports that only 10% of Latinos contact mental health specialists. Researchers have found the issue of stigma, cultural miscommunication, and misunderstanding of cultural counseling services contribute to the underutilization of mental health services, and lack of bilingual services may also limit Latinos' access to mental health services. Can go to slide 2. So as I mentioned earlier, Kimberly Volker, who's our graduate student, completed this this epidemiology research and completed this part of the last year for the Oregon Advocacy Commission Office and the Commission for Hispanic Affairs. So to better understand how Latinos utilize mental health services, we've reviewed the data pertaining to Oregonians who had initiated mental health care via State of Oregon between 1983 and 2013. And who had terminated mental health treatment between 2010 and 2014. So in this whole review, there was hundreds of thousands of data entries that we reviewed. 15 variables were analyzed, and these included gender, age, ethnicity, education, training, which was whether a subject was currently involved in school or training, the referral source, which was the individual, group, or institution responsible for getting the patient into care, income, the type of treatment the patient received, the county where the patient lived, as well as where the patient received treatment, and the prioritization of which the patient belongs, marital status, living arrangement, employability, payer, and termination type. So this presentation is going to focus primarily on the age, county, eligibility codes, and term payer. Next slide. The Latino population was much younger than the total population, with over half of the Latinos receiving health care being under the age of 18 years of age. The median age for Latinos who received mental health services was 17 years. This compares to a median of 29 years for the total population, so much younger population. Likewise, in this total population, only about 30% of the patients were under the age of 18 years. For this reason, some of the analysis performed was stratified by age. And in that analysis, it was done for minors only and adults only. And here we'll see the Latino population is more geographically concentrated than that of the total population. Close to 2/3 of Latino Oregonians receive mental health care, live in Multnomah, Washington, Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County. With the percentages of Latinos living in Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County about 11% greater than that of the percentage of the total population living in those three counties, and the percentage of Latinos living in Washington County more than doubling the percentage of the total population living in this county. Okay. However, things look a little different when we look at minor patients. The percentage between Latino minors and all minors residing in Multnomah County is now the same, and the percentage of minors living in the other counties has decreased. Mm-hmm. So the eligibility codes, so this is kind of an interesting area of definition in terms of acuity and, you know, chronic care and those that are lower grade of services, but it just kind of helps define it a little bit more. So priority 1 are considered severe persistent mental illness, or SPMI, and or serious emotional disorder, SED, and if treated, are at risk of hospitalization, priority 1. non-SPMI or SED, priority one, an individual without severe and persistent mental illness or serious emotional disorder but is still at risk of hospitalization if untreated. Priority two individuals are least capable of obtaining assistance from the private sector due to nature of their illness, their geographic location, or their family income. And priority three individuals are those who are experiencing mental or emotional disturbances but will not require hospitalization in the foreseeable future. Priority one patients are also marked by an immediate risk of hospitalization for the treatment of mental or emotional disorders and are in need of continuing services to avoid hospitalization or pose a hazard to the health and safety of others or themselves. Okay. Most minor patients were found to be at priority two, although we see a greater percentage of Latino minors compared to the total minor population are priority two clients, so 49.40% versus 36.25%. The percentage of Latino minors who are SPMI or SED priority one or non-SPMI SED priority ones are less than that for the total minor population, so 12.59% versus 21.19%, and again at 27.25% versus 30.85% respectively. When we look at adult patients, we see the difference between the percentage of Latino adults who are at priority two that is substantially greater than that for the total adult population. And we see the percentage of Latino adults who are priority one, this segment has also increased, showing a greater need for this type of service among the older population. And finally, well, not quite finally, but a little bit more. the payer refers to the primary source of payment for the services delivered for the patient. Patients in the total population are more likely to have indigent-funded billed services, whereas Latino patients were more likely to have Medicaid. Title 11 services, AMHA services, state and federal grants, or other public assistance programs responsible for payment of these services. So these results have important implications for identifying the needs of Latino patients receiving mental health care in Oregon. From this, we see that the Latino population enters the mental health community at a much younger age than the general population. Furthermore, the Latino population is more strongly clustered in some areas, which may be of a concern if these counties do not have the resources to adequately meet these patients' needs. Thank you.
Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members, now I'm going to give you my findings from a qualitative perspective. So first I'm going to do an overview, give you some key findings, talk about some recommendations from individuals in the field, and then some policy implications. So first slide is the overview slide.
There it is.
So this is a qualitative study. I interviewed 16 people throughout Oregon targeting both rural and urban areas, and specifically in areas that had a majority of Hispanic individuals living in them. The people I interviewed included social workers, program managers, executive directors, educational professionals, and members of the Catholic Church. And for the study, I interviewed 12 bilingual and bicultural and four other that were bilingual. My interview questions focused, I ask about barriers to mental health for Latinos and also ask about what would improve services for Latinos in the state of Oregon. And most of these individuals had 10 to 30 years experience working with Latinos. So, and for the purpose of this interview, I divided into systemic barriers, which are more policies and practice barriers that inhibit ability to access mental health services, and also individual. And the systemic does impact the individual. Okay. So first I'm going to talk about systemic barriers. And I listed these in order of frequency of response. in the people I interviewed, so you can look at those as I speak. So the number one was lack of culturally specific mental health services. And this could range from lack of bilingual, bicultural providers, interpreters not being appropriate for helping out with mental health, lack of appropriate psychotherapies or mental health interventions for Latinos. So that would be a lack of culturally specific mental health. And I have a quote here from a provider in Bend. It's really not about stigma. It's much more about the inappropriateness of mental health services. In our community, things aren't culturally appropriate because we have a dominant cultural narrative for how mental health services should be provided. Okay, and number two, this ties in again, the lack of bilingual, bicultural providers. Latino mental health clinic provider told me, I think it's really important to have bilingual and bicultural providers because having an interpreter does not work. Even if we do have a bilingual, bicultural interpreter, there's no consistency in care, and that is a barrier.
Senator Gilzer.
Thank you. Could you expand a little bit on bilingual and bicultural, especially bicultural?
The meaning of that?
Yes. Thank you.
So bicultural meaning being of that particular culture, Latino, having some, either being a resident here or a non-resident with.
Thanks. And just follow up.
Please.
And just because we're on the record and learning about this and
yes.
moving into other, could you put a little bit on the record why that piece is important, that what the barrier is that's created if you have a person that's just with an interpreter as opposed to with somebody that's both bilingual and bicultural?
So from what I found from my research, people tend to drop out sooner. I did speak with a provider at Unity, and they just said the interpreter doesn't know the background and history, and for the Latino culture, you really need to have integrated care where the whole family's involved, and sometimes interpreters don't know the language well enough, and it depends on the country they come from sometimes about different nuances in languages. So there's just a real disconnect there, and often people drop out.
Thank you. Yes, Chair, Vice Chair, Senator Gelser, a wonderful question. I think we understand or begin to understand that clinical therapeutic relationship is really a primary relationship. And so when you introduce a third individual, it really gets in the way of building trust. It gets in the way of communication. If you can imagine being a woman who has had a traumatic sexual assault and sharing that with potentially a male interpreter in the room who is then going to relate that to your therapist who then is going to have a tertiary response, it really doesn't fit well with the therapeutic model and creates distancing and then safety issues, I would say psychological safety issues. So it's a less than ideal model of care, to say the least.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I know you're going to get into recommendations a little later, so I'm going to ask this question now, but you can hold on answering it if you want. Because what I don't see on the recommendation is anything around how do we recruit more people from the Hispanic community into these professions, right? Because all of these barriers are reduced if we have more people who look and have the history of the people that they're serving because of exactly the points that you're making. So at some point in this presentation, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that particular issue.
Thank you, Senator Steiner-Hayward. We will address your questions, and I'm getting old, so you'll remind me that you have that question for us when we get to that point.
Welcome to the club, Mr. Marias.
Okay. And I'm going to go to the next, number three, we're still at barriers, systemic barriers. So number three is fear. Fear in the community is exacerbating all barriers. Latino clients are less likely to seek out government-provided mental health services because they are worried about ICE and documentation status, and that's from a program coordinator in Medford. We have seen a lot of fears, and the number of Latino clients has dropped. I get a lot of questions about whether I will be reporting them and what I am writing on the forms. There is a lot of mistrust and worry about coming in for mental health care. The idea of feeling safe is tied to residency status. And that's from a provider in Deschutes County. So, okay, and number four was inadequate funding was a real barrier for mental health services for Latinos. Many said that mental health and medical dollars are separate, and funding for programs is separate and specific. One provider in rural Oregon said, if a person has diabetes, then we can treat the mental health, but hopefully they first have diabetes. So, and how we distribute funding in Oregon is a huge barrier, and how this funding is structured is another major barrier, and that was from a program director in Portland. So another person suggested it'd be great to have access to general funds. Number five is lack of integrated mental health services. So there's a model now of integrated primary care and behavioral health, and that happens to also fit the ideal model for a Latino culture of just starting with a doctor and then being referred to a behavioralist, because it reduces the stigma associated with mental health and it creates this continuity of care and avoids dropout within the mental health care system. So that was one suggestion that was made by many of the providers I interviewed. And number six was a lack of awareness about mental health services. That's more of an outreach issue and education issues. And maybe I think from the quantitative data we've seen that maybe starting with youth and in the schools is the place to begin engaging Latino youth in the process and educating families about mental health issues and resources for them. And number seven was a lack of acute mental health services for Latinos. Okay, now I'm gonna move to individual barriers. Again, fear came up. Someone I interviewed in the church stated that people in the Latino community cannot live under such stress and not be impacted in the long term. I am specifically thinking of the kids and the lasting trauma. And number two for individual barriers, and this is more talking about individuals and trying to access the mental health system, was the lack of insurance. Even though there has been expansion in the Affordable Care Act, it often is tied to residency status, and this fear is also contributing to people not wanting to enroll or engage in the system. Number three, mental health services are not culturally relevant. I think I addressed this kind of in the systemic barrier. So again, there's a dominant cultural model out there for psychotherapy and mental health services that doesn't really work for Latinos. Again, this shortage of bilingual and not being able to access alternative therapies such as curanderos because it's not billable. And then more, the mental health services now are, again, dominant culture and tend to be compartmentalized. We're not engaging a whole family. We're just trying to engage individuals. And there's other external factors. Just trying to access it would be not having childcare. The facilities aren't really appropriate for Latino clients. Like having community centers or community-based, just coming to a mental health center is not appropriate from what people told me. Lack of transportation and hours are not appropriate. Number five is stigma was also pointed out, that it's still kind of a stigma to admit that you have a mental health disorder and need help. Again, that ties back to maybe more of an integrative care, going to a primary care physician. And lastly, I talked about this in systemic too, was lack of education. Okay, so now we can move on to some recommendations that I heard from individuals I interviewed. And again, these were kind of in order of response of what people thought would be the best for addressing these issues. So first was integrated primary care and mental health, which I've talked about. And then, so I have a quote here, integrated care works because you come in for primary care and there is no stigma about mental health. A patient can be assessed and referred. It is culturally familiar and they feel welcome. Most staff are Latino. It is totally different dynamic than an agency that is focused towards Caucasians and has language barriers. And then number two was integration of mental health services into the community centers. So where a community center exists, you put the mental health into the, say, community center. And again, the stigma is avoided and people can access that there with their families. It doesn't become a separate compartmentalized mental health thing, which again creates the individual barriers. A third recommendation was culturally specific mental health clinics, specifically for Latinos and geared towards their specific needs culturally. And lastly, another was a platform model, which means you take, say, a school, like I don't know if you're familiar with the Sun School system, that already has a lot of resources in it, and you integrate mental health into there, and you have specific Latino counselors, or if it's predominantly Latino, then you integrate into that. So there's one area where all the resources can be accessed. It's not so separate. Every time a resource becomes separate, it becomes very hard to access. So that was what I was told by many of the people I interviewed. Or a community center, or a church.
That's fine. You can finish your sentence. Okay. It's okay. You don't have to. It's all good. Okay, so this is where I'm going to circle back to my health care provider question, and I'm going to ask another one. So okay. Why don't you start with that one with the chair's indulgence.
Please.
Thank you. So why don't you start with the question about providers? Healthcare providers. How do we attract more people?
Thank you.
Have the same cultural heritage.
Yes,
Senator, and the same language.
Senator Hayward, it is a challenge. It is a structural and systemic challenge. The bottom line is we don't have the pipeline right now of folks who are being trained, who are going into our universities to become qualified mental health providers. When I first arrived in the state of Oregon, I was the only bilingual bicultural provider serving all of Southwest Washington, if you can believe that. That reality actually has not changed much. We have a number of qualified mental health therapists across the state who are bilingual and bicultural, but between my vice chair and I, we can likely count them on two hands. There are not a lot of them. Some of the solutions that we are working toward, we've done so with your help. So when we passed the Traditional Health Workers Commission, not only did it include promotoras and promotores, but it included peer wellness and peer mental health specialists. So this gets closer to your question of how we begin to build paraprofessional models that can assist those few who are a number who are master's level providers, for example. They can begin to do screening, they can begin to do some of the education, they can begin to refer folks to services, either primary medical services or other related services. But the pipeline is still not what it needs to be. So we need our school partners to do more outreach into these communities, to offer educational opportunities to begin as early as elementary and high schools to begin to recruit from our communities. There are some very real structural issues, and I'd like to invite Vice Chair Castillo to also weigh in on answering this question.
Absolutely. I'm also one of those mental health professionals who has kind of also been pretty involved in providing services in Multnomah County. And our observation has been really it is a structural and systemic issue. We have providers who are doubling more than when we were at the very beginning of our profession providing mental health services. But what we find time and time again is that it's the difficulty in terms of the support within the agencies. These are individuals who are providing bilingual services, so they're providing services in two languages, and they're bridging barriers and chasms of service. So they're not only providing mental health services, but case management services and connecting to a lot of things. So in some ways, they have a double caseload in what they're doing. And if the agency doesn't provide the support in understanding the bilingualism, the barrier breaking that they're doing, it's very stressful for those providers. And so building a pipeline that's supportive and also grows is really what we need to do. Yeah.
So if I may, Mr. Chair,
please.
First a quick comment, suggestion on this last part. The first is
Mark Overbeck in the Health Authority is doing some really interesting work with oral health and outreach, and so it might be helpful to connect with him because I think he's doing a similar culturally specific outreach model to improve oral health in communities that have traditionally had health disparities. Mm-hmm. So that may be helpful. The other thing I would encourage you to do is Representative Nathanson and I passed House Bill 3261 last year that provides a funding pool for developing new training programs for healthcare providers with a particular emphasis on primary care and behavioral health. And so I would encourage you to talk to Julie Hanna, who's been working with OHSU to develop the rules and the criteria around that, about incorporating some piece of culturally specific training to actively promote people from the Latino community. The second piece that I want to just bring on really quickly, in terms of the platform model you're talking about, I was wondering about whether you were going to talk about that a little bit, because I know that in, for example, traditionally black churches, engaging the pastors to talk about diabetes or hypertension, engaging barbers and hairdressers, mm-hmm. right? Because those are people trust, for better or for worse, and they see you frequently and can have conversations with. So I like that model. It's been proven effective, and it is a group of people in the community that people tend to have ongoing relations with and see as trustworthy people. So interesting to see if that model is useful.
Chair and chairs and committee members, another model that we've also found very effective is the Sun School model. In Multnomah County, there's a program known as Bienestar de la Familia, which is wellness of the family. Mm-hmm. And this is an integrated care model where there's a health clinic, and there's also an opportunity for case management, drug and alcohol services, mental health services, and a variety of community services in one site. And when Diana talks about the stigma that community may feel requesting services, when they come in and they're able to receive health services and then also talk with someone there, you know, specifically about some of the depression they might be experiencing, it kind of reduces all of that fear and that stigma. And then there's a variety of services that they're also able to receive within one center and one site. So I think, you know, looking at a variety of platforms is really useful.
Representative Melissa Leo.
Thank you, Co-Chair. You know, we've had this conversation on the dais around what can we do better to help create opportunity in mental health area. And we know that we need to recruit more folks to become mental health therapists who are bilingual, bicultural, who are culturally sensitive, who understand. And I know we had a program where, I'm also on the higher ed committee, and back when they started a program to recruit more teachers, to become teachers. And so just curious and thinking about, can we use that model to recruit more people to become, thank you, mental health therapists in the Spanish-speaking community? Because I think it needs to be more intentional, more systemic, because we need it. It's obvious based on the data that you all provided. So I just want to throw that out there as a possible solution, and we can look at that model and see if we can, you know, adopt some methods from it.
And just kind of as a check on the time, we have one other program that's supposed to go about, 40 minutes, and so we're going to need to probably wrap up in the next 5 to 8 minutes.
Thank you. I have some closing comments to make, and really an invitation to this August committee, as you'll hear. As we travel the state from Portland to the mid-Columbia Valley to eastern Oregon to central Oregon to southern Oregon, the coast and the Willamette Valley again, we get to hear about the vibrancy and the resiliency of this community, which is now, as you've heard, 500,000 strong. But we have also heard about some of the unmet needs, and always I hear that the top unmet need for this community is mental health. Senator Steiner Hayward, you are on point to say that the number two unmet need for this community is oral health. Our families are at this time in our history experiencing tremendous stress loads. As a result, our families and our children are experiencing a great deal of trauma, Many of our children, for example, are reporting PTSD-like symptoms. This, coupled with geographic, linguistic isolation and the dearth of Latino mental health providers, as you've heard today, threaten to create the perfect mental health storm for our community. Add to this some of the findings of our report, which include a limited number of qualified bilingual, bicultural providers, low insurance rates, a generalized stigma associated with seeking out mental health services, dominant system models of care which do not meet our needs, and lastly, inadequate funding for culturally competent trauma-informed mental health services. As evidenced by this report, there are ample opportunities to strengthen mental health services for the Latino community by designing integrated models of care, by ensuring that we have the necessary pipeline of future culturally specific providers, such as peer mental health specialists, for example, as a recruitment strategy. By making investments in Latino-serving mental health providers, we will ensure that this community has the access to the mental health services they need. We wanted today to come before you to share our findings with you and to begin the conversation about how we as a state get to mental health parity for Latinos. How do we engage and get the support of this August committee or a legislatively appointed task force to start looking at a cohesive set of best practices and policy recommendations to ensure that as our children experience mental health issues, that they have the access to the dignified services they need. We hope to count on your support as we continue to explore this issue with you in future sessions. Thank you again for your time today. And we have Director Paksiresht, who is here from DHS, who has been a lovely partner, as has OHA. I don't know if your schedule allows, but he is excited and prepared to just make a few comments on behalf of this issue today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Come up. Good morning, right. Co-chairs of Steiner Hayward and Rayfield, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Fair Board Paksiresht, Director of Department of Human Services. Mm-hmm. Just very briefly, I support the report from the Commission. We have been very engaged and partnering with the Commission in preparing this report. As we all know, the Latino population in Oregon is a growing population. In fact, when I was in Oregon Youth Authority, the percentage of the Latino youth is much higher than the overall percentage of the adult Latino population. So these are our children who are going to be our future adults and our future leaders. So to the extent that we can help get our head around this issue and try to provide service equity, which is a primary value for our organization, we support that and will participate in any committee or a task force that would move us toward that future. Thank you.
All right. And with that, we'll go ahead and move into our next informational hearing on the update on our eligibility transformation and integrated eligibility and Medicaid eligibility projects. So.
Ireland, would you like to do an introduction?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the next item on the agenda this morning is an update from the Department of Human Services on the Eligibility Transformation Project and on the large Integrated Eligibility, Medicaid Eligibility Project. The system project did go before the Joint Legislative Technology Committee last Friday. If you're interested, there's more materials posted under that meeting. There's a report from Gartner and some other information if you want to dig into that topic, a little more detail on the IT side of the project.
Please begin when you're ready.
Again, good morning, co-chairs Steiner Hayward and Rayfield, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Fair Board Paksiresht, Director of Department of Human Services, and with me today, we'll start.
Good morning, co-chair Steiner Hayward, co-chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Ashley Carson Cottingham, and I'm the Aging and People with Disabilities Director.
Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield. My name is Kim Fredland, and I am the Self-Sufficiency Director at the Department of Human Services.
And Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tony Black. I'm the Independent Project Director for the Integrated Eligibility Medicaid Eligibility Project.
We're here this morning to provide you with an update on the One IEME Integrated Eligibility and Medicaid Eligibility Project that will support Oregonians in their access to health and human services. Every technology project hopefully has a business driver behind it, and it's generally focused on creating efficiencies, but even more importantly, improving customer service and the customer experience. As you know, Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services provide essential services focused on creating an environment in Oregon so that we can all be healthy, independent, and safe. For DHS, the successful implementation of this project will mean that those people who receive services from our self-sufficiency program and aging and people with disabilities are able to complete a single application that will provide a range of services and multiple programs to some of the most vulnerable Oregonians. Together, these programs serve over 1.2 million Oregonians a year. Exploring the best practices in the field of human services, as I'm beginning to look at best practices and learn from that, I have become even more aware of the importance of the successful implementation of this project and how it can help the Oregon Department of Human Services become a more mature, more responsive organization focused on outcomes. So I'd like to share with you a brief video about the Human Services Value Curve, a framework for business model development across four maturity levels to deliver outcomes and impact for those who need our services.
Today's human services landscape is more challenging than ever. It's an environment clouded by demand, complexity, mandates, and cost, where resources are being cut. Despite this terrain, organizations must grow their capacity to deliver better outcomes, supporting individuals and families on the path to their full potential. But how? Renewal is about evolving and maturing the business model over time, focusing on organizational, process, and technology modernization that cultivates change for agencies and for the people they serve. The nation's human services leaders created and refined a framework to chart this growth. The Human Services Value Curve tracks business model development across four levels. The higher the level, the greater the capacity to deliver outcomes and impact to people in need of support. The first level is the regulative business model. This model is a starting point for all human services organizations. It's a basic business model to deliver services to eligible people in compliance with requirements. And it's working in the nation's public welfare offices every day, where technology interfaces, data sharing, and incentives are helping agencies to achieve compliance excellence, reflected in a national SNAP error rate of less than 3%. The next level is the collaborative business model. The business model matures beyond a singular compliance focus to deliver the best mix of services to people by breaking through boundaries for collaboration and information sharing around policies, programs, and processes. It's at work at the District of Columbia Department of Human Services, where the Strong Families Program provides wraparound support from multiple agencies and community partners. And new processes and policies are improving service integration between the TANF and homeless services populations. The next level is the integrative business model. Continuing to broaden capacity, this business model focuses on seamlessly coordinating and integrating services. It's about working at the optimum level across multiple programs to transform service with one-stop options, drive participation, and make the most of data. This is exactly what's happening in New York City with the landmark HHS Connect program that connects 35 programs and 15 agencies for game-changing data access information sharing, and interagency collaboration. The most advanced level is the generative business model. It's an innovative, future-focused model of human services delivery that addresses complex family problems and social and economic issues to generate lasting outcomes for people and communities. In this model, leadership, operations, technologies, and processes are adaptive, and innovation is continuous. While no jurisdiction has yet achieved this, Washington State is making exciting inroads. Here, officials started with an impact statement that reflected the full scope of how human services would connect into the community. The human services value curve is not a one-size-fits-all framework. Even specific programs can be at different levels. Moving up requires a relentless focus on outcomes, adaptive leadership, leading technology, and innovation. It is possible to reach the top and empower services and improve lives. The place to start? Understand where your organization is today on the human services value curve. Because to move forward and make an impact in human services, it's important to know where it all began and where it must go.
If I had to take a guess as to where Oregon falls on that value curve, I would say we're probably somewhere in the one or the perhaps maybe closer to the two category. And even though achieving the highest level of maturity takes some years, and both a business and cultural transformation, we've already started planning to advance the organization up toward that maturity level. And here's where this project and this technology actually begins to show its value. I'm going to turn it over in just a minute to Kim and Ashley to talk about the work that they've been doing across their program areas to transform the eligibility process and allow us to leverage our staff resources to best meet the needs of those who come to us for services. And naturally, less time navigating screens and systems equals more time face-to-face spending with clients. And after their presentation, then Tony will present the technology aspect of this project.
Thank you. Good morning. So when we talk about the integrated eligibility technology project, it's really important to then also pivot to talking about eligibility transformation. The Integrated Eligibility and Medical Eligibility Project is really providing us the technology solution to move to a fully task-based model, which we'll talk about a little later. Kim will be covering in the presentation. So DHS and OHA will be able to take advantage of the technology to align our financial eligibility processes and truly move toward a no-wrong-door approach for Oregonians. Today, Oregonians in need of DHS and OHA services and supports generally have to visit or call multiple offices for those supports and services. In the future, Oregonians will be able to apply in one place for many, many services, and this will be no matter which office they visit, which there will be a single phone line and also an online option. We'll no longer have to point them to another location if they walk into an APD office and they need a self-sufficiency service. The rules engine in the technology will allow workers to determine eligibility at either location or online or over the phone. This also, it's important to point out, this also includes our Area Agency on Aging partners that are the APD field in certain locations of the state. They will also be using the same integrated eligibility solution. We're calling the offices that people walk into storefront offices, and this is where Oregonians, if they need the Oregon Health Plan or any of the services that are offered through self-sufficiency or APD AAA, they can walk in and have in-person support. An additional benefit is that there will no longer be different applications for different programs that someone might need through DHS. There'll be a variety of ways, as I've mentioned, for the consumer to interact, online, phone, mail, in person, and they really decide, the customer or consumer decides how they choose to interact with us. They can also make changes if they move or have a name change through multiple avenues. We're working to create an end-to-end process, and this will help us to ensure that it's consistent no matter which location the customer decides to utilize. And we're doing that through the business side in collaboration with the technology project to make sure that we have consistent business process. So as an example, a complete process for an applicant may be 25 different steps. And the integrated eligibility IT solution in the actual system itself, there may only be 15 of those 25 steps. So the business side, our programs are really working to make sure prior to the rollout of the technology that we have that full business process in place and we really know exactly what interactions we're having with the customer, the utilization of the solution, and getting them their benefits. In the future state, eligibility staff, this is the financial eligibility staff, will be cross-trained both for APD, AAA, and self-sufficiency services. And the ones that are in this system are Medicaid, SNAP, TANF, and ERDC, as well as the Oregon Health Plan eligibility. Next slide. So the visioning work around eligibility transformation started at our central office here in Salem, determining what we really wanted this to look like in its final stage. But after this, and before we could make hardly any progress, we really needed to engage our field staff across the state and to hear everybody's perspective and have buy-in for the direction that we were going. So, Kim's and my programs held a two-day kickoff in October. We brought together 110 participants from across the state, from AAA's, APD, self-sufficiency, Oregon Health Plan, the DHS Director's Office, and folks working on the IT solution. There were four work groups convened during that session, and they continue to work together. Oh, is there a question?
Thank you, Chair. I have a quick question. So I'm a visual learner, and I'm trying to understand this eligibility system, which I'm super excited about because it's going to be centralized. So if I'm a person who is wants the Oregon Health Plan, right? So I go and register. Will it automatically say, because you qualify, you also qualify for other state programs? Is that how it is going to work, or do you have to identify the programs that you also want to be eligible for or qualify for?
Co-chairs, Representative Alonzo Leon, I'm pretty sure that it's a single application, and so you can fill out your information. If you only wanted Oregon Health Plan and you were not interested in SNAP, even if you qualified for SNAP, you could indicate that. Mm-hmm. But it would determine eligibility for all programs.
Excellent, thank you.
Based on a single application.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So during our two-day kickoff that we held in Roseburg, there were four work groups convened that have, again, leadership from both of the programs and staff from across the state. Each work stream, the four work groups are up here on the slide: Central Services, Change Management, Infrastructure, VEC stands for Virtual Eligibility Center, and Storefronts. Each of these groups is has been chartered. It's creating a stakeholder list. It's creating a communications plan, identifying milestones and deliverables, looking at barriers and risks, developing an implementation and monitoring plan, and then coordinating with all the other work streams. The work groups have now met from right before that conference we held in October through the end of December, and they have presented their findings to some of the central office leadership. There's 148 pages of recommendations, and so right now the different project managers assigned to those work streams are refining the recommendations, and then we'll be aligning that to all of the deliverables on the technology side and to make sure that it's all working in unison. Next slide. So this graphic shows you a little bit of what the future state will look like. We're going to have virtual eligibility centers, and the vision is that a virtual eligibility center will have multiple physical locations, but will act as one singular center that can share work. So if one of the virtual eligibility centers is maxed out, they have a lot of tasks building up, it would seamlessly transfer to another center to be able to pick up some of those tasks so that everybody is receiving the same service, as I mentioned earlier.
Center Steinhardt.
Just to clarify, when you say virtual eligibility center, you basically mean call in. Or is there something that I'm missing here? Because if we're asking people to navigate through a series of push button menus, I'm not going to be a happy camper because they're not going to be happy campers.
Senator Steiner Hayward. It would be a workforce of individuals who could answer phone calls, take applications over the phone, and also be working online applications. So they would be able to be assisting the Oregonian okay. with whatever their need is through a couple of different channels.
So they're work centers, but not for people to walk into. They're for people to phone or for those people who are working there to do the online work if they aren't getting phone calls.
That is correct.
And the workload would get transferred around automatically mm-hmm. depending on the volume
yes.
coming in.
And the idea is to eliminate, you know, wait times and
And there'd be
delays.
A single call-in number for the entire system. It would just get transferred around according to who was first available.
That is correct.
Thank you.
So the vision is that the virtual eligibility center locations would be stood up in rural areas of Oregon to increase economic development and ensure that there's more job creation. And these might be in areas that have lower rent, more rural locations. And so that's sort of the vision. Some of the virtual eligibility centers may be in other areas. And then we'll also have storefront offices. And these will look similar to today's offices, but will be able to leverage staff resources to best meet the needs of Oregonians. We will still have case management services in our storefront offices. In particular, I want to point out that we will always have, you know, long-term care case management, because after you complete or while you're completing financial eligibility, then you have to complete the service side of eligibility with case managers. And then in the self-sufficiency program, the family coaching would also be a handoff so that that could be completed for their programs. The offices may be co-located with a virtual eligibility center. So it may make sense to have a storefront office and a smaller virtual eligibility center in the same building, depending on what the real estate looks like and when we're exploring what will work the best. We also, it's important for us to have storefront offices in locations that are easy for Oregonians to get to. I think we've had a bit of a trend of moving offices out to larger buildings because of rents going up in downtown areas. But with this new model, we could rent a smaller space where Oregonian can still walk in and receive that in-person support. And it also is in alignment with us really looking at service equity, ensuring that we're meeting people's needs where they are.
Mr. Chair. So does that mean these offices are the offices that have recently been moved away from population centers to where people can't access them are now going to be moved back into population centers?
Co-chair Senator Gelser, I don't think we have a plan to do that, like a concrete plan, but as we work towards eligibility transformation, we would be looking at all of our locations, looking at where it makes sense for APD self-sufficiency to combine, because we will have a workforce that can do that frontline financial eligibility in a storefront office for someone. So we'll be looking at that. But I can't speak to whether a building would be moved.
Can I just do one thought? So in a community like Representative Rayfield's district and my own, there is a brand new DHS building being built to order. Will they stay there? I mean, already this sounds like a change in a facility space need. The child welfare facility space need is different than what it was, since there's a hotline screening area being built there and there'll be a centralized screening in the Tri-County area instead. What is there a risk of that building
moving or will it stay?
Do you want me to take that one? Co-chairs and Senator Gelser, so this is where the challenge comes in when you're working in long-term facility leases and plans, and we really are trying to set the vision for where we're going in the future, and we believe that this will take us many years to actually move to this direction. What we're really looking for is as we're talking about new facilities, so we know that we've had a change, and so as we look at new facilities, we really want to be moving towards this storefront and virtual eligibility center. So I believe that you're mentioning the Corvallis office. Mm-hmm. So what very well may happen there is that Corvallis would stay a child welfare office. It would very well stay a storefront office. We may look in the future at some point of having a virtual eligibility center there that kind of is taking up some floor space, but that we, if there is a need in another community where we may want to open a small storefront. So that's kind of that balancing that we're trying to do, is not increase our overall footprint and make sure that we're thinking long term about how we go from the current structure to the future structure. So, this is probably going to take a decade or so.
Well, and just one more follow-up. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I would like to follow up with this. Mm-hmm. More. This just sounds, for our community, it is relatively, the new facility itself mm-hmm. is great.
Yes.
But it's very disruptive, especially for self-sufficiency, to be moving from a storefront location where people that lacked access to transportation were able to access it. Now it's moving to a much more remote location that is in a high-income area, not a low-income mm-hmm. area, and very difficult for people to get to. Mm-hmm. So it just, mm-hmm. it seems like the philosophy of this is significantly different than what is literally being hammered out right now in our own community. And if self-sufficiency and APD are now located together and they move away, does child welfare stay alone? I would like to know more later about how my community fits into this vision of best practice.
So Co-Chair Senator Gelser, what I can tell you is that our strategy around the space is going to be, to the extent possible, we're not going to build anything new right. or rent more space. As an example, Kim just announced in Eastern Oregon a number of new positions being basically recruited for, and we are using our existing capacity. For example, in Enterprise, how many, 10? So to the extent possible, we'll use existing capacity, and clearly every building that we build, and I don't know the specifics about the Corvallis office, but I'm pretty sure we have entered into that lease knowing that transportation will be available, even though, it's away from its current location. But there are some pretty basic criteria that we use for placing buildings and locations. And I can tell from your expression that you're not happy with that. But, our focus is going to be on cost, on access, on services. And as Kim said, we'll, as we move along, we have 170-some buildings across the state, and we'll try to leverage our existing capacity. Space is expensive, so,
Director, actually, we have 10 minutes and 7 slides to go, so
sure.
Let's keep moving, and then we can sure. take this offline, or we can have a whole hearing on this. What do you guys think?
No.
All right. I'm overruled.
Your co-chair is vetoing that one.
Please continue.
That's really the end of my presentation. I did want to point out that we didn't mention earlier that consumers seeking IDD services also come through the APD or AAA door for financial eligibility. So it's broader than just the individuals that APD and self-sufficiency serve because of that front end financial eligibility. So there are benefits to many people that we serve within the agency. Now I'm going to turn it over to Kim Fredlin, my esteemed colleague, to continue.
Thanks, Ashley. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. as just picking up on this same slide, some of the differences that we are going to have when we're looking at offices is that we have had over the past 5 or 7 years this move towards much larger offices where a lot more staff are in those offices, and that's part of what the philosophical change really is. There's another change that is happening, which is processing centers. In self-sufficiency, we have in 5 areas of the state what we call a regional processing center, and they don't see people walking in the door. What happens is when an application or an applicant comes in and the application is processed, once that upfront work is done, that case is actually carried or managed or maintained at the processing center. And so all of the interaction with the customer then is over the phone and through the mail. We actually are going to move away from this model. The regional areas that they're in are usually more metropolitan areas where, again, the rents are a lot higher. These are larger offices. And when Fairbourse talked about we are starting our first virtual eligibility center in Eastern Oregon, it's not new positions, but we're actually moving vacant positions from a metropolitan area to a rural area. And so we'll be filling them in that location. So that, again, is part of the transition. So individuals, our employees, will not be impacted because we are looking at this change through attrition, and we'll be moving vacant positions as they come through towards this new model. So again, it'll take us a number of years to make this change. So when we talk about aligning the service delivery between self-sufficiency and APD, there's I would say, learnings that we've had over the past 8 or so years. So one of the things that happened is during the height of the recession, literally our caseload in self-sufficiency doubled at that time. We got no additional staff to handle that increased application, and we needed to figure out something to do. Luckily, the DHS agency was working with McKinsey in doing a lean bringing lean methodology to us, which self-sufficiency really embraced. And we were able to look at our business model of applications and renewals and really completely change how we interacted with Oregonians through that process. We were able to develop a process that 8.5 years later we are still using, which means that when an Oregonian walks in the door to apply for services, our goal is to see them within 30 minutes. And when the caseworker sees them for that application, gets all of their information, unless there's something they need to bring back for us for the eligibility process, we actually process that eligibility that day so that they walk out with their benefits. So this is a really important thing for people that are walking in hungry and needing SNAP benefits, for instance, or medical services right away. We want to get that to them as soon as possible. So this is part of the guiding principle of this eligibility process, or this IT project that we're working on, is that it's built on this model of really being efficient, seeing people within 30 minutes. One of the things that is interesting is that right now we have an online application that was implemented about 6 years ago that it doesn't have as much technology advancement as the new technology that we'll have, and so our online applications actually take longer than walking in the door and receiving services. So that's part of what moving to this new technology will allow us, that advancement, so that we can process applications as quickly as when someone walks in.
And just so you know, we have about 4 minutes and a bunch of slides, and so
fast.
I want to make sure I get everybody off to where they need to be on time, so
thank
I just
you.
Wanted to give you a time update.
Tony's got just a few things.
So the other part of this is that really moving to a task-based model. So the way that our current IT mainframe. These are very old technologies built in the late 60s and early 70s that we currently use. They're all built on a case-based system, meaning that individual caseworkers like have cases or own cases. So a task-based system really is what Ashley described as. We prioritize all of the tasks so that every Oregonian receives the same type of service. So one caseworker doesn't get behind and the Oregonians they're serving get a different level of service than another worker who maybe is not behind. So spreading that task-based system out, we have, again, over the past 8 years through our lean processes, moved our model that way, but it's very work intensive because it's all manual at this point, which is what the IT system will bring to us, is really automating that task-based system so that, as Ashley described earlier, the tasks that need to be done can be automatically spread around the state as opposed to an individual person assigning work where it needs to get done and managing that over our workforce. So, yeah, yes. So what, just really quickly on this particular slide, the cell phone kind of says it all, is that this is not new work that we're doing. This is really about an evolution of our work, and the technology is really going to advance us to the next step of that task-based model that we have been doing for a number of years. So we just wanted to make the point that I think sometimes people think an IT system totally changes everything. It's really not. It's really going to advance us to taking advantage of that task-based model in a way that we can't currently because of the manual nature of it. So I will end there and turn it over to Tony. Thank you.
All right, Tony. Two minutes.
Okay. Real quickly, I would like to share with the committee that in December of this year was 2-year anniversary of the One System, or the Magi Medicaid system, going live. And in that time, in the 2 years that it's been in operation, we've served over 850,000 individuals through that system. And we also have 150,000, as we expand the system out to SNAP, TANF, and non-Magi Medicaid, and employment-related daycare, summer meals, those things. We will have another 150,000 cases annually in the non-Magi Medicaid, 130,000 SNAP cases through APD and AAA offices, and another 285,000 through SSP, 24,000 TANF cases, and about 8,000 employment-related daycare. So we're going to significantly expand our footprint in terms of the Oregonians we can receive benefits through this system. And I'll just say also that about 65% of the Oregonians that utilize this system will be for multiple benefit programs. So I think that we will receive return on investment from the initial investment in the One System, capitalize on that investment as we grow it out. So just real quickly on the project, we re-baselined the project January 12th of this year after contract amendments with our system integrator and our quality assurance group, and so we have then brought in Gartner Consulting to do an independent assessment of our schedule and budget. We have the bullets on the last slide in this deck that I will leave. We mentioned briefly, but in the interest of time, I'll leave it with that. I also have a slide in here that talks about the expenditures over the three bienniums that this project will be in progress, including the last year in 21, where we talk about maintenance and operations. We have a $195 million budget this biennium that we are anticipating underspending by $30 million. We will be back in the 1921 budget process to request our final year of design, development, and implementation of about $144 million. And then the $44 million for the first year of maintenance and operations and project closeout. Gartner, I won't go through this slide in detail, but just suffice it to say that Gartner has reported to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology on Friday that our scope, schedule, and budget is within is actionable within reason and actually on the low side compared to other states. So, you know, I would encourage you, if you want to drill in a little bit more, to either review the presentation on Friday or the materials that are out there from Gartner. The full report and their presentation is out on OLIS. So, thank you.
Thank you. We're a little over time, but if anybody wants to stay,
quick question.
Representative Hayden, quick question.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So my question has to do with one thing that we've struggled with getting. Coordinated care organizations are often on the front line. They have funds available for community benefit. With the new kind of virtual approach here, will they be allowed to have embedded employees paid for by them to help with that virtual process?
So, co-chairs and Representative Hayden, certainly they could, because in the new process, they could have what I would call application assistance, where they, using the online application to apply for all benefits, they could have individuals helping Oregonians complete that process. So, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Thanks for being patient with us as we try to get through this in a timely manner. And with that, Ms. Byron?
Subcommittee, the plan is to come back and meet on Wednesday to pick up the discussion and have an informational meeting on the Intellectual Developmental Disabilities Program.
With that, we'll go ahead and close the meeting.
Thank you.